Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Sangamon Auditorium, UIS Springfield, presenting George Bizet's romantic opera, Carmen, on Friday, February 25th at 8 p.m. The opera tells the tale of Carmen, a dangerous temptress who easily captivates the masses. Ticket information at 800-207-6960.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning as we begin another week. We're also pleased to welcome back to the program Bill Rose. He's a research architect at the Building Research Council at the University of Illinois. And on this program, he's the man we call our radio architect because over the years, he has been with us many times here to talk about the design and construction of buildings. And this is, it's a little bit different than the kind of thing that we do every month when Hank Spies stops by. That's kind of a troubleshooting thing. Although we have actually done some of those kinds of shows with Bill. But moreover, I think what we're interested in when Bill stops by on these programs is we talk a little bit about how it is we get the buildings we have and why it is that some buildings we love and we love being in them, and other buildings we say, I don't love that one so much. We have talked a little bit about buildings and why it is that some of them function better than others. We've also talked about architects and what they do and about the relationship between people who design the buildings and then the guys who actually have to build the design. And sometimes that is a difficult relationship. It's fraught with all kinds of difficulty because, you know, it's one thing to design something on a piece of paper. It's another thing to actually have to build the building and make it do what you want. So every once in a while, Bill is here, and I always like to think that we never actually finish the show. It's just we sort of say, we'll pause there, and he'll come back, and we'll talk again another time, and that's what we always do. One of the things that we've talked about quite a bit, one way or another, is historic preservation of buildings. And that's at least part of what we'll talk about here this morning as we talk about some of the projects that Bill has been involved in. And if you have questions or comments, you can certainly call us. And that number is 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana folks and toll-free 800-222-9455. It's good to see you again.
Good to be here.
One of the things that we thought we would talk a little bit about is the Farnsworth House.
Right.
And this is something now, it was in the news for a while, and I'm not sure that it's gotten much mention lately, although I did come across a piece that was published in the Sun-Times last fall about the fact that a lot of people, since it has now been open as a museum, a lot of people have gone there to see the building. This is a house. It was designed by a very famous architect, Mies van der Rohe. And the reason that it had been in the news is that some years ago, the person who owned it wanted to sell it and eventually find someone to buy it. But they said, well, what I really like to do is take it apart and move it, take it someplace else. And a lot of people felt that they wanted to see the house preserved in its original site.
Right.
And managed to find the money to do that. And so ultimately that's what happened. And it's still there in Plano, where Mies put it. For Dr. Farnsworth.
That's right.
And there are a lot of interesting stories connected with the house. The big one, I guess, that I came across when I've just done a little reading about it is that Dr. Farnsworth didn't like it. She was steamed. She was steamed when she got the bill. She was not happy with the house itself, although the architect said, look, I showed you the plans. You signed off on the plans.
Right.
But then when she saw the house, she thought, now, wait a minute, this isn't exactly what I got in mind. Maybe for anybody who has not seen it, you should describe it.
Okay. From Champaign, for example, you just go straight up 47 from Mahomet. So if you're looking for a day trip, you and your family, don't miss this. Don't miss it if you're coming from Chicago or from anywhere in downstate Illinois. It's considered to be one of the handful, a half dozen or a dozen masterpieces of U.S. international style 20th century modern architecture. And believe me, it lives up to its billing. I investigate a lot of historic properties for water problems and that sort of thing. And so I get to see these buildings from the inside out, sort of like seeing a celebrity in the dressing room without the makeup and costume and in a bad mood.
I like that metaphor.
But this building is knocked my socks off, I have to say. How did it do it? My work is more in building technology than design, and everyone who's listened to this program knows that architecture is the marriage, sometimes the divorce of art and technology. And sometimes the people who talk about improvements and mastery of building performance steer clear of talking about beauty or aesthetics. And often that it's hard to find a vocabulary that these two sides of architecture share. But one area that is shared is the idea of elegance. Anyone who has done a mathematical proof or come up with an engineering design knows what elegance is. That is the achievement of complex ends with the simplest of means. We know what that is in building technology, and elegance is everywhere in aesthetics. So we can share that, and that's what jumped out at me in this building, that with the fewest possible moves, with the greatest reliance on Occam's razor, this piece is able to provide visual and human comfort needs that with the fewest pieces that I've ever seen. I often try to value engineer a product and say, well, what can we subtract from this? I'm compelled by elegance too, and there's really nothing to be subtracted, but you can of course subtract way too much and not allow a safety net. But this has the minimum number of pieces to deliver a project. He's one of the architects who's done this. Frank Lloyd Wright has done it as well, try to take away the safety net. And whenever we see a building like this, we say, ha-ha, now we're going to find out where this building is starting to go bad. And this one is a keeper. This one is managing water, is managing thermal requirements with the a real minimal palette, set of tools. The building looks good in its surroundings from inside the building. The outside looks good. It's framed by these the giant panes of glass. I'm very happy that it was able to stay where it is, because it from inside the house you have to say that the lot, the trees, the Fox River are essentially a part of the house. Mm.
Just so that people can get an idea of what we're talking about. Recently, another famous architect passed away, Philip Johnson. And one of the buildings that he was really known for was the glass box house, which was essentially a house, a small house, that where the walls were windows.
Right.
Well, this is kind of that same sort of deal where there is it feels as if there's no boundary between the inside and the outside, because most of the what would we would think of as the walls are in fact giant windows, and it's kind of looks like it would kind of be like living in a glass box. And I suppose the thing that I wonder about is that's great, but on the other hand, there are times when you want privacy. You don't want to be living in a glass box. Now, maybe depending on the setting,
right.
If it was out in if it was sort of in a remote area,
right.
And it wasn't like your house was on Green Street,
right.
That would be different. Do you feel at all exposed when you're inside the house?
Yeah. Yeah, you do.
Yes.
Okay. I'd hate to raise a family. Well, it has one bedroom, so you don't raise a family in the house. It really is a weekend getaway. You couldn't really can do everything you need in a life here. It's a second place. It's a party house.
And that really was what it was designed for.
Yes.
That was the idea.
That's right. That's right. You mentioned about Dr. Farnsworth and how unhappy she was with it. She did stay there for 20 years afterwards. So we have to temper that perception of criticism. But this raises the question of of what architects are there for. They're there, according to the state, to ensure the health, safety, and welfare of the living and occupied environments for people. They use clients' money to do things, so you would think that they have to meet the needs and wants of the clients. Is this enough? And architects will say no. There's a little something beyond this that architects have to achieve, beyond their obligations to the state and to the client. And skeptics like me are probably the last people to be persuaded of that something else, that something more. And I don't get persuaded of that very often, but yesterday I did.
I think the other thing that I remember having looked at some of the pieces about the relationship between Meese and Dr. Farnsworth is that when she got the house, she said something to him about, well, you can't live in this house. And he, heroic architect that he was, has said, look, madam, I wasn't designing you a house to live in. I was designing a work of, you know, something like that.
Sure.
And initially, she sued him. Mm-hmm. She tried to take him to court, and the suit was tossed out. And as you say, she lived in the house for a long time. So she must have eventually made her peace with the house. But I guess that illustrates the popular image we have of a lot of architects, that in fact they're not really designing buildings for us to live in, they're designing works of art, and whatever sort of inconvenience might come with living there, we're just supposed to suck it up and just deal with it.
I hate to say that, because it opens the door to architects cheating their clients in millions of different ways. Still, I hate to close the door entirely to the achievement of these other aims.
Mm. We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. And I believe that they are on our line number one, and I think in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Hello.
I'm delighted that this home is now open to viewing. I've been trying to see it for about 6 years. I have daughters who live in that area. And was it the state that made it possible for the public to see this? And another question, in all the years that the house lay fallow, so to speak, were the gardens destroyed? I read once that there were beautiful gardens surrounding this house.
The effort to ensure the preservation was undertaken by the entire preservation community, not only in Illinois and in the U.S., but also worldwide. There's a group called DOCOMOMO, the Society for the Documentation of Monuments of the Modern Movement.
Excellent.
But it has moved to the hands of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. They are the owners, and it's managed by the Landmarks Group of Illinois. It's not open this winter. It will be. I think it'll be closed during several of the winter months, but it will be open for to the public, I think, for most of the months of the year.
Will there be a sign off Route 47 directing people to it?
I don't know. You should contact the National Trust or the Landmarks Group to find out what signage there will be. I know that they are planning to make sure that it's better seen from the river road, at least, that goes from 47 over toward Plano. We should also mention that politicians have played a role in this, and I understand that Representative Hastert had a hand in ensuring some funding for the building.
Yes, that's near where he lives, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And about the gardens, are they?
The gardens are very difficult to keep up because of flooding, occasional flooding of the Fox River. The building is a box that's elevated up about 4 feet, 4 or 5 feet above the soil, In 1996, there was a flood of the Fox River that where the water level was about halfway up the height of the living space inside the building.
Uh-oh.
And there are spring rains that bring the level of the Fox River up about to the level of the lower terrace once a year. Given that, it's really difficult to maintain the gardens.
In defense of architects, I'd like to say that I think since Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect-client relationship has greatly improved. I learned in an architectural history class that he surveyed his clients thoroughly before designing a home. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for the call. Other comments, questions are certainly welcome. We're talking here this morning with Bill Rose. He's a research architect at the Building Research Council at the U of I. And occasionally is here, and we talk about buildings and architects and what architects do and why it is we feel about certain buildings the way we do. And one of the issues that we've talked about quite a lot is historic preservation. And we're talking a little bit here this morning to start out about the Farnsworth House. It's in Plano, which is not very far from Aurora. It's on,
right.
It's on the banks of the Fox River, and it's a house that was designed by Mies van der Rohe and completed, I think, about 1950?
51, I think.
Was in the news for a while because the building had been the house had been sold, and the guy who bought it said, well, I would like to take it apart and move it. And a lot of folks here in Illinois and people who are interested in architecture all over said, no, we really would like to see the building stay in its original site. And so money was raised to make that possible, and it is also now open to the public, and you can go and see it if you like. And Bill also, by the way, has a book coming out that we want to plug. I'm not sure if this is a book exactly for the general reader, but it's a book about It's a book basically for architects about water problems.
That's right.
In homes, which is actually something that we've talked about, you know, before on, right. on the program as well. So we can talk about that. Maybe someday you can come back. We can talk about water problems. Of course, the risk is we'll get those I have water in my basement questions. What do I do about it?
Well, you could elevate your house above the ground the way Mies van der Rohe did. Then you don't have a basement. And there you go.
There's an idea.
We solved that one.
Let me return to a question because here, as I talked a couple of times about the fact that somebody came along and said, well, I will buy the house, but I want to move it. And that, as you said, and as we said, a lot of people said, no, we really want to see the house stay in its original place. Why is that so critical? I mean, if we were going to say, well, I'll preserve the house. I just want it in New Jersey, okay, because I live out there. I don't want it here in Illinois. And I'll move it and I'll find a really nice spot for it and I'll put it there and you'll be very happy. I mean, why is it so important?
I think there are a lot of ways to answer that question. There are some people who say there's a genius of the space, there's a genius of the land, that there is when a building is placed on land, that there is an attachment that can't really be described technically. Perhaps that's true. We don't I'd hate to argue one way or another on metaphysical matters like that. I think that, for one thing, buildings are heavy. they're really not made to be moved, except those that in fact are. And in this, it's interesting that this building is attached to the ground only by eight, let's say, columns that touch the ground. If there's any house that's movable, this one would probably be considered. And it was probably a push toward for the mobile home industry to recognize that some homes actually do go from place to place. Actually, mobile homes don't. They have wheels, they have a chassis, but it's really rare for them to be moved from one place to another. I don't know. I think that a house is just an enclosure in a place that the inside is the outside, that we're always connected by doors and windows. And if buildings have character, if they have personality, that kind of change is rarely improved by moving. from a technical point of view, the house, the building, actually includes the sort of donut of soil that surrounds it. And the house will settle into that. The building will settle into that. And for it to settle into a new place is, I don't know, it's like changing your feet. Good question, but I'm not sure that I have – maybe at this point the best answers are sort of touchy-feely.
Yeah.
I've thought of how to help the Farnsworth house protect itself against rising floodwaters by having pylons that might elevate it. Go ahead and float it and attach it with cables. I don't think they're going to do that. Okay, I don't think there's any risk of doing that. But imagining a building that floats and could be moved from one place to another, I think can be met both optimistically and pessimistically.
I'm interested in your thoughts as an architect and engineer kind of guy about the practical or impractical features of the design. For example, it has a flat roof, and flat roofs are notoriously troublesome. I know one of the things that Dr. Farnsworth complained about was it was extremely expensive to heat because of the glass windows,
right.
Walls, essentially. I mean, how does this – if you take the artistic considerations
right.
out of it and you simply look at this as a machine,
right.
how well does it function?
It doesn't cut it. Sorry about that. but it's a flat roof, and it's a Euclidean, or it was intended to be a Euclidean flat roof. One thing we know is that Euclid never makes it into actual buildings. We like to see a pitch on roofs, and this one doesn't have one. So instead, it has little bellies that allow an inch or more of water to stand on it. Part of the work of making it linger for centuries to come is going to involve better management of rainwater. And that was a subject of about half of our discussion. Meanwhile, there's a technology fix at work. It happens to be a very watertight membrane that's being challenged by the amount of ponding that's on it.
Hmm.
But it's not as though Mies van der Rohe didn't understand about water. He has a very interesting design in the terrace that's exposed. This terrace has marble on the surface, and beneath that there's a gravel base, and beneath that is concrete, and beneath that is are precast concrete panels, and all of these are sitting in steel channels that make little rectangles. This is about 1,000 square foot terrace area that's dead flat. So you can imagine the challenge of not having frost heave and water management. But the concrete is actually sloped to drains. It was raining yesterday, so we were able to see rainwater trickling out of these drains, the rainwater that would land. There was one thing that he didn't foresee. He has buried a good water management layer within about the 10-inch thickness at the terrace. One thing he didn't foresee was acid rain. And what has happened is that the marble on the surface has been dissolved a little bit by the rain. That dissolved marble then precipitates at the drain and forms little pieces of marble that actually block the drain, forms little stalactites coming down. And if you have stalactites, then you have stalagmites. So you have these little mounds of dissolved travertine marble sitting underneath the terrace. It's easy enough to ream those out to get it draining more easily again. But I think that the overall design, at least of the terraces, permits good rainwater management. And he hit it so well that nobody, you've got to get way under the terraces to be able to find out how he actually did manage the rainwater.
Okay, well, let's talk with someone else here. We have an Urbana caller here, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, to set the situation or environment here. I understand there was an article, and I'm trying to find it, in the News Gazette about a woman in the local area who has a house that is highly insulated, you know.
Yes.
Anyone that knows would be nice to, you know. But Mandurah was not known for high energy efficiency, right?
No.
In terms of the buildings, I mean, a lot of complaints. I moved out of the Chicago area, and certainly his buildings. Could you elaborate on that to a certain degree?
Sure, I'd be happy to. The house that you're referring to, I believe, is a house that was designed by Katrin Klingenberg, who is an Urbana resident. And she has studied energy-efficient construction, design and construction in Germany and in the United States. It's a very interesting house. I believe that she was unaware when she started promoting super insulation in Champaign-Urbana that super insulation was invented in Champaign-Urbana by the Small Homes Council in the 1970s. So we have a multifaceted tradition of energy-conserving, energy-conscious design of buildings and of houses here. Ms. Klingenberg can be contacted, I think, through the School of Architecture at the university.
Oh, good.
Yeah, you hear me praising Mies van der Rohe and this building, which is energy inefficient. I hate to do that too much, of course. In fact, the building was originally heated with oil, and it's been converted to all electric heat. This helps keep things clean, keep things safe, but it doubles the overall energy cost for the building. And in fact, some of the solutions to the wet spots of the building may involve keeping them warm. If surfaces are kept warm, water resides on them not quite so well.
Yeah, I guess it also depends on what side of the building. Now I'm actually going back up to Chicago in terms of there. It depends on what side of the building you live on.
That's true.
And what year.
That's right.
You know, I mean, in terms of whether it's winter or summer. I mean, it just, I don't know how these people can contend with it, you know. But anyway.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Right, thank you.
Thanks for the call. I guess that sort of gets at the question, is it possible to have a building that is both beautiful, just knock your socks off beautiful, and energy efficient?
Good question. I'd like to hear what the the public has to say about this. There's this building materials are cold, they get wet. I mean, cold things tend to be wet, and warm things tend to be dry. You learn that doing laundry, for example. And by insulating our buildings, we're making the interior surfaces nice and toasty warm and therefore dry. But by the same token, if we add insulation to a building that has never been insulated, the exterior materials during cold weather become colder than they used to be. Thus, they become slightly wetter. I think we're waiting to see if there's some sort of tipping point here, or we're waiting to see how strong is the argument might be that perhaps for reasons of durability, we want to be cautious in the use of wall insulation. I think we can just go right ahead on ceiling insulation. I think there are a million things we can do to save energy in buildings. But there might be a durability energy conservation trade-off on wall insulation. We need to study this more.
Okay. Our guest is Bill Rose. He's a research architect at the Building Research Council at U of I. And every once in a while here on the program, we talk about design construction of buildings in various sorts of ways. And here this morning, we've been talking specifically about a house. It's in Plano. in the northern part of the state was designed on Mies van Dro. It's called the Farnsworth House, called that because it was built for someone named Farnsworth and was the subject of a preservation effort because a few years back it was someone came along and the owner said, well, I want to sell this building. Someone came along and said, okay, I'll build that, but I want to move it. And that started a great effort to not only to preserve the structure, but to preserve it where it is. And today it is available to the public. It's open to the public for not year-round, but it's open to the public, and it is possible to go and see it. And Bill says, if you have the chance, you really should because it's really something. Mm-hmm. Right. We have some other callers here. Let's talk next with someone living in Downs, not too far from here. Line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. I am wanting to stay on houses, but get a little more pedestrian here. Wondering what you think, if you're aware of, the Glide House designed by Michelle Kaufman?
No, I'm not familiar with it. Could you describe it?
It's a manufactured home. She studied with Frank Gehry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a beautiful little house. Very contemporary. And you build a foundation, they come in and set it down like a mobile home.
Mm-hmm.
But it is nothing like a mobile home. And very environmentally friendly as far as I can see. Although I've seen the installations, I've seen pictures of, are in warm weather climates.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know and haven't really investigated enough to know whether it's well insulated, et cetera. A lot of glass, at least on one side.
Have you seen the building or one? Are there several buildings?
I have not seen one in person, no.
Oh, okay.
But you can find pictures at glidehouse.com, and the architect is Michelle Kaufman.
Well, that sounds very interesting.
Very interesting, and designed so to take advantage of breezes, you know, that kind of thing, with solar panels built in. And they claim you don't even have to connect to electricity. But
well,
that might be tricky.
That might be. But there is a real challenge in trying to develop a manufactured home that can be used in several climates.
Sure.
That's I believe that there is a certain climate specificity to buildings. And okay, in a building like the Farnsworth House, it's that requirement is snubbed in the interest of aesthetics. Still, you raise a really good point about the mobility of homes and design applied to them. I look forward to taking a look at that.
Yeah, look it up on the web. It's very interesting, and everything comes with it. They claim that building costs are about half of the typical, you know, constructed on-site house.
Very good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, thanks for the call. Other comments, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. That sort of gets at yet another subject of that we have talked about and one might talk about, and that is, you know, what can you do to provide affordable housing if you're going to start from the beginning, if you're going to build a house and find one that sort of an average middle income family can afford. It's very difficult.
Yes, it is. We know that we're using up farmland at an alarming rate in order to build homes. One thing that's often ignored in providing homes, low-income, affordable homes, is the fact that we have a whole lot of houses out there. The building stock is enormous in this country. And a lot of the discussion of affordable housing centers around the ideas of making new housing cost less. I think we need to put a whole lot more effort into making the existing houses that we have perform better and suit better to a growing population.
Let's talk with someone in, Winnebago, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes. Hello.
How do you, have you compared the design of that house in Plano with Mies van der Rohe's buildings at Illinois Institute of Technology, which was a complete campus, included living and school and research facilities?
I haven't, but it's nice of you to mention that this isn't the only, by any means, the only example of Mies van der Rohe's work in the U.S. The IIT campus, the Seagram's building, the Lakeshore Apartments, and the buildings in the Chicago Loop. There are a lot of examples of his work. This just happens to be the one that I was at yesterday.
Okay. I lived thank you for and mentioning. Worked at IIT for 40 years and watched them build the whole thing. Uh-huh. There were leakers. They were hot. They were cold. They were terrible. You couldn't do anything in them. And, of course, with all the glass, you couldn't arrange anything. But and of course the elevated ran right through the campus.
Right.
Nowadays they did put a kind of a tunnel around the elevated, so that reduces the noise somewhat. But it was terrible. But leak, and of course you're mentioning the acid rain. There is a courtyard, and the basement under the 20-story skyscraper office research tower had been treated similarly to how you described it, and the whole bloody thing rusted out and had to be replaced. So he may have been a great architect, but boy, what a disaster. It was just like Frank Lloyd Wright.
Well, your points are well taken. I remember in the 1980s, there was a survey of the 10 best buildings in the United States and also of the 10 worst buildings in the United States. And there were three buildings that appeared on both lists. That is the criteria that makes for good buildings in the eyes of some architects can be absolutely infuriating, exactly as you described, to people who have to use the building and have more practical and less esoteric attachments to the buildings.
Yes, but what's that house out east that was built? Wasn't it designed by a student of his who just died?
Yes, you're talking about the Philip Johnson's glass house.
Yeah, wonderful. Just wonderful. Mm. But, of course, totally unlivable then.
Right.
So, well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, that, I suppose that is the challenge if you live in a – if you have chosen to live in a house like that, you have to –
have another house.
Well, yeah. You have to live the building. You have to love that building so much that you're willing to put up with whatever downside that there is, I guess.
I guess. To me, it teaches a lesson. I get the opportunity to dig into buildings by famous architects. Mm-hmm. And these architects weren't trying to take it easy. They weren't playing soft. They were they were sticking their necks out and daring the building to fail, which they did. And I profit from that. I learned so much more from building failure than from soft success of buildings. Clients can fairly say to me, sorry, I hate paying for your education, Mr. Rose. Nevertheless, I appreciate a plan without a net.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to Terre Haute for the next caller. That would be line number one. Hello.
Hi. There was some discussion earlier on about whether a house can be beautiful or good-looking and be efficient. And about 20 years ago, we built a house north of Terre Haute. Julia Petal, a local architect, helped us. And we love our house. And it really is very, very efficient. We heat it completely with the heat pump and some passive solar. And we really like it, and both as a functional house and as a pretty house.
That I think you're pointing out something that's very good and very important, and that is that meeting the requirements of energy conservation, functionality, and beauty is actually more common than many of us give architecture credit for. But often these buildings are not showing up in magazines. They're often not the signature buildings. They just happen to be the highest quality buildings that we have, and they don't draw so much attention. They're not misbehaving the way a lot of other buildings are. I didn't come up with a building myself, although I can think of dozens of them. I think for precisely the same reason that you just mentioned, they're there, they're economical, they're pretty. We love living in them, and if you discover them, fine. If not, they're doing their job of keeping us happy.
Yeah, that's and we have tons of glass in the place, and we look out over a nice northern view over a lake. And so we do get the northern winds coming, sweeping across the lake at us, but Juliet really did a very good job of compensating for us.
We keep hearing the names of women architects. Something must be happening in the field.
Oh, well, Julia's dead. She was a Frank Lloyd Wright protege.
Uh-huh.
And she built many, designed many public buildings in the Terre Haute area.
Very good to know. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call. Bye. Well, I'd feel fairly confident that today, if we looked at the number of women that were in the architecture program and compared that with, I don't know, 40, 50 years ago, I'm sure that we would see a lot more.
That's right. I think a good half, more or less, of the students in architecture school are women.
And are there more architects that would identify themselves? I don't know if they would say they were practicing green architecture, but that's one of the terms I think that people have come to apply to an architecture that's concerned about impact on the environment. It's concerned with energy efficiency and design and construction, that those are just things that routinely these designers incorporate into their design.
Yes, green architecture is becoming very common. And it springs out of the recognition in the 1980s that striving for energy conservation isn't enough. The impacts of what we build and how we build it, our buildings have a greater impact on the environment than just how much energy is extracted in oil. Instead, all of the resources have to be looked at. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find an architect now who is not, in one way or another, a green architect or claiming to be a green architect. There's a certain competition. There's marketing. There's I don't know. We're becoming quite commercial in this green business, trying to come up with standards. The standards they're not as scientific as I might like to see, a little more political than that. Nevertheless, they represent a very important effort on the part of the building community.
We have a couple of other people here. We have maybe about 7-8 minutes left with Bill Rose. We'll talk next with someone on our line number 2. Hello.
Hello. Yes? You just led into the question that I was going to talk to you about, and that is, you speak of preservation and as far as preserving the building, but what I'd like to speak to you about, and I'm sure architects probably don't even consider this very much, is that these older buildings, once they do definitely get beyond their useful life, have some resources in them that are just really fabulous and unavailable to us nowadays. And I like to call it logging urban America, in that these buildings come down and a lot of the lumber that's in it is lumber that it's just not available any place in the world now because it was original growth lumber, very, very high quality.
Right.
Barns have it. Old factories have it. Out on the East Coast, they get heart pine a lot from the old mills and stuff that they're tearing down. We see it here. I'm in a near a small community called Danville. They've tore down a lot of the older buildings here, and I've been able to get some wood out of it, but people don't think along those lines of salvaging this lumber that is phenomenal lumber.
You raise a good point that first growth lumber is as irreplaceable a resource as the petroleum that's underground. There is an effort in Champaign-Urbana to salvage old buildings managed by PACA, the Preservation Association of Champaign County. And many other cities have salvage efforts as well. Still, all of these salvage efforts recognize that we're dumpstering irreplaceable material and doing it at an atrocious pace. I like keeping the buildings in place intact as much as possible. Salvaging, of course, is a backup plan in case the economic forces actually take the buildings down. But the preservation people are getting pretty upset with the green people. The green people are saying that we're saving resources, and the preservation people are saying you can't even come close to the resource savings that we are able to achieve. And I'm kind of with the preservation people on that.
Well, sometimes buildings do go beyond their useful life. The roof goes completely bad. The underpinnings are totally rotten. There's not very much lumber even available in some of these buildings sometimes. And they just do have to tear them down. They do go beyond their useful life. And sometimes people take the fixtures out of them, but a lot of times they totally overlook the phenomenal lumber.
Right.
So thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for the call. As you say, there are organizations like PACA, and what they do is if the building's being torn down, they try to salvage whatever they, you know, doors, right. windows, staircases, right. doorknobs, I mean, you know, it's just right. any old radiator or something, pretty right. much whatever's worth having.
It's a volunteer organization. Get involved.
Yeah. The thing that I wonder, though, is thinking about what the caller said, I guess I thought that most building codes actually say you can't use a lot of recycled building material. Do I have that right?
Yes, to some extent. There are standards for products that are referenced in the building codes, and that makes it you're right. That is an impediment to using some old materials. Yeah.
I suppose if you were building your own house out in the woods, you could do whatever you wanted. But I suppose if you're building in the middle of downtown Urbana, that's you do at least have to abide by the Urbana building codes.
That's right.
We'll try and get one more caller here. I think line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering if we could go back for a moment to the Farnsworth House and talk about its livability with all that open plan and glass walls. How are the bathrooms treated? And since Dr. Farnsworth lived there for 20 years, she must have made some sort of modifications to make herself happy for that amount of time. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. The bathrooms are totally enclosed. They're actually very nice. They're not particularly spacious because all of the service elements are contained within a core. Nevertheless, they are far and away the most conventional part of the house. There's a little bit of storage. I think most people would want more. Where can we put this stuff would be a big question in that building. But still, it's as a weekend retreat, I think it's doable.
It does look to me that, and I'm looking here at a website that has some pictures of the house, that some places there are some curtains.
Yes, there are curtains that can be drawn to cover all of the glass.
Oh, so you can if you want to.
Yes.
Cover all.
And the curtains
glass.
Are integral to the design of the building. And in fact, they are so opaque that they tend to, they're good insulators, and they tend to chill the outside surfaces and lead to a little bit of corrosion.
There's a trade-off. Sounds like there's trade-offs no matter what you do. Well, we're almost at the point where we have to finish. Is there some big lesson to be drawn from this particular place when we're talking about preservation?
I would say yes, in that we all have certain expectations of what our living spaces are supposed to be, and let's shake that up a little bit. Let's visit places like this and ask these kinds of questions of what can we and can't we do in a building. I think it's inspiring that way.
All right. Well, and the book now that you have coming out?
It's titled Water in Buildings, An Architect's Guide to Moisture and Mold. Wiley is the publisher. Their website, Wiley.com, has a lead about it. It'll be available next month or so.
Okay. Well, maybe next time you come back, we can talk about that.
But you interview authors by phone. Maybe you're going to have to call me on the phone rather than invite me to the studio.
I'll have my people call your people.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Bill Rose, he's research architect, Building Research Council at the U of I, and every once in a while he is here on the program, and we talk about the design and construction of the built environment. Programming here on the station's made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting three operatic hits during the month of March, Leonard Bernstein's Candide, performed by the U of I Opera Program, and Bizet's Carmen and Verdi's Aida, performed by Opera Verdi Europa. For more information or tickets, visit their website, KrannertCenter.com. Focus 580 also made possible with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Coming up a little bit later today as part of the Afternoon Magazine, a rebroadcast of an interview with Oxford historian Timothy Garton Ash. He says that Washington cannot rule alone and Europe cannot realize its aspirations without the United States. His latest book is titled Free World, America, Europe, and the Surprising Future of the West. This is, again, an archive interview, so that means no phone calls today in the 1 o'clock hour of the show, but of course you can tune in and hear it. Celeste Quinn is the host, and as usual, the program gets underway at noon with news from NPR, the BBC, AM 580. We'll also have weather, sports, a lot of other things. That's the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn following this program. Coming up in the next hour of Focus, we'll be doing our regular Talk to the Family Doctor show with Dr. Jeff Swearingen from Carl Clinic. We'll take your healthcare questions. Before that, though, we'll take a break. We will have news and an update on the markets.
Thank you very much. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets. Soybeans rallied on the open, climbing through the 100-day moving average near 534, but since have backed off on a lack of follow-through momentum and have been unable to work higher. Funds were buying beans early on reports of hot and dry conditions in South America. The wheat contracts are seeing more pressure.